This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Today's episode is sponsored by The Reason Speakeasy, a monthly unscripted conversation in New York City with outspoken defenders of free thinking and heterodoxy. Go to reason.com/events for information and tickets to the next one. My guest today is Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar, the co-founder of Ideas Beyond Borders, a nonprofit that translates books and articles about limited government, freedom of thought, and market economics into Arabic and other languages, and then distributes them for free in the Middle East and other parts of the world. So full disclosure, I'm on the board of IBB. I talked with Faisal about Ideas Beyond Borders' new book, Untold Stories of the Middle East, which celebrates entrepreneurs in Kurdistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, whom IBB has given startup grants. How the October 7th attacks on Israel and fighting in Gaza and Lebanon will affect the region for decades. And what it was like to grow up in Baghdad under Saddam Hussein, various Islamic terrorist groups, and the U.S. occupation. This conversation was taped in front of a live audience in New York. Here is the Reason interview with Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar of Ideas Beyond Borders. Faisal, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so...
Some people like me over here.
Yeah, some people love you. Very quickly, what is Ideas Beyond Borders?
So the mission is to bring a free and a prosperous Middle East.
Okay. So we're doing it. A pipe dream.
It's actually real, and that's what I think what the book is going to represent, and I hope everybody gets a copy and reads it. But really, it's the bold vision is to bring a free and prosperous Middle East, and how we actually do it is that we equip people with the knowledge and the skills and the resources for them to take action to make the values of freedom and liberty accessible and actionable.
Okay, and well, we're going to go in a little bit. We'll talk more about the origins of IBB. But right now, one of the things we're talking about is a collection, a book that you put out called The Untold Stories of the Middle East, which has to do with a particular initiative that you guys have been funding. Tell me about The Untold Stories of the Middle East. What is it and why did you produce this book?
So I'm going to start with the why. And we started in 2017, and our first initiative was to really make the ideas of classical liberalism, largely ideas of freedom, available. And slowly, we started from zero to million, to 2 million, to now 8.5 million subscribers in 7 years. And as we were spreading these ideas, there were many people who were messaging us, telling us that they want to take an action on these ideas that we're spreading, whether they're people who are following us directly or from the adjacent communities within the larger, I would say, liberal movement within the region. And so we started having conversations with actually some people, Rob and Tyler Cohen from the Mercatus Center and other, about how can we actually build a system that actually supports these initiatives. And we went with a model that is cuts a lot, most of the red tape and most of the, and making it easier for people to get funding and for them to take the action. And so we started this fund, which we call the Innovation Hub, which is really about supporting innovation and solutions in the region. And this book is really a collection. We have supported by now roughly 250 startups and even including political parties, et cetera. And this is like I don't want to have favoritism because most of them have been great. Some of them are not, just kidding. But most of them have been amazing. And this is like really just a brief of many of the really amazing heroic stories of people fighting for the values of freedom. And it came, unfortunately, in times of war. There is actually, so we wanted to like really show that these people still exist and they're still doing the big fights, and there's actually their stories continuing, and they're available on our website at Ideas Beyond Borders. We publish actually stories of this almost every week.
So, I mean, you're talking about you guys give micro grants essentially, plus support services to people who are trying to start businesses. You do a lot of work in Kurdistan. IBB has an office in Kurdistan as well as New York and DC
and UAE
and Dubai. UAE. Okay, so. Tell me about, there's a couple of businesses in Kurdistan that you guys have helped get going. What are they?
So again, I don't want to put favoritism, but I can tell you one of really inspiration stories. And one of actually a business called Kurdwares, which is featured in the book, is that there was ISIS war, and there were a lot of Yazidi refugees, a lot of religious minorities who got suffered a lot from ISIS. And what he did with him and some other businesses also featured in the books is that they actually get them jobs. They started a leather company that actually produces, not only for the ecosystem around them, but to the worldwide audience, to the diaspora Kurds in Germany and other places. And he needed like really a push, small capital for him to build that system, for him to export overseas. And then he started making lots of revenue that he was able to hire so many people. So like with little money, he was able to actually create so much change. That's one of the ones. The other story that I also like is Lego, which is kind of like Uber, but for women inside the Kurdistan region, but also in Mosul, which is south of Kurdistan region. And there were a lot of, because of cultural differences and women feel unsafe going with a male taxi driver, he was like, you know what, there's a business opportunity here. So actually women could be part of the economy and they can actually go to work, etc. And we supported that business and really it became very successful. One other one, which I don't think is in the book, but still amazing, which is of a lot of Afghan refugees and Iranian refugees who live in the Kurdistan region who are building carpets. And carpet industry actually has a high markup and they needed a small change for actually for them to start the business and be able to spread overseas. That's like just some of my favorites, but there's a lot in the book.
What is it about the Kurdistan region that seems to be doing so well when we talk about the Middle East and particularly areas that were part of the Iraqi war or, you know, the American invasion and occupation of Iraq? Kurdistan seems to be doing pretty well, even though it's not technically its own country, et cetera, or maybe because of that. But can you talk a little bit about why Kurdistan seems to be flourishing?
Well, I mean, technically, Kurdistan that featured in the book that we talk about is the semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan, which is part of the Iraq, but it has its own territory, its own parliament, etc. And not to bore you so much with the details, but I would say these are kind of the three key elements. Number one is that the U.S. had a very specific intervention when it comes to the Kurds in 1991 after the first Gulf War, which is like, we cannot help a lot, but we're going to create a no-fly zone to prevent Saddam Hussein from using chemical weapons against that. So it was a very specific mission towards that. The other thing is that the leadership there, which is led by the PDK, sometimes called the KDP, found out that, number one, they don't have a lot of oil. So in order for them to have more independence, there is no better independence than economic independence. So as they started growing, first they actually started with support from the Soviet Union, which is actually a very interesting story. They started first on the left and mostly on the communist left, and that's where you see the split in the Kurds between the PDK and the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is actually a recognized terrorist group by the United States and Turkey. And the KDP took like the more free enterprise model, which is like, we don't have a lot of oil, so we actually cannot build a fat government that is dependent on heavy salaries. So let's move the country slowly towards privatization. And my organization is actually helping that with the grant and help of Atlas Network for us to push towards that. And then the other thing, so we have the third element, which I think rarely talked about, is that there was a lot of push of secularization within the Kurdish communities over the past decades that actually moved them away from theocratic forces that exist in the rest of the Arab world, or the rest of Arab world in Iraq in particular. So I think these three key elements, which is privatization with a dose of secularism, with a dose of independence, it creates the flourishing that we have. And actually, Scott, who's, I think, from reason, visited Kurdistan in one of our support in the past couple months. So I actually went there. I think some of the people here went. Is that it's I wouldn't say it can be the next Dubai, but you don't actually have to be the next Dubai, but it's definitely, if people can just Google Empire Erbil on Google and you see the new downtown, that is really a significant development of develop, especially economic development.
One of the other businesses that you talk about is set, it's in Lebanon and it's a jewelry producer. Can you talk about that?
So a couple years, I think 3 years ago, there was a massive explosion, which I think most people assume it's Hezbollah who did it, in Beirut, and it's called the Beirut explosion. And many of the and businesses, especially small businesses, were destroyed as a result of that explosion. In a government that is amazingly corrupt and divided, as we have seen in Lebanon, many of these businesses have nowhere else to go. So because we advertised the existence of the Innovation Hub, they started actually reaching out to us of many of these victims of the Beirut explosion. Sometimes actually,
Do we know what caused the explosion at this point? Or?
So there is a lot of theories. Which, like, if you go to the Middle East, you ask 10 people, you get 20 theories. The most likely theory is that it was used as a kind of weapons for it to store weapons, and then something went wrong and exploded. And so that's, I would say, the most likely theory. And because of corruption, so many of these startups didn't, they were like, they had a lot of amazing store from jewelry to clothing. And Lebanon has always had a great history of really creating these things. It's been known as, used to be called the Paris of the Middle East, but it's always been a place of culture and art and creativity. And I studied English there. So if my English is bad, you should blame Lebanon. But it's that's where, like, so there's a lot of these enterprises that were destroyed, unfortunately. And then with the help of IBB and help of our donors, we're able to kind of push them to the next level. And Lebanon, I think there is this, don't quote me on the statistic, but I think about 60-70% of Lebanese people live actually outside of Lebanon. Significant part of them live in Latin America. They immigrated in the early 20th century, and then some of them moved to the States. So the great things about some of these businesses, like the jewelry, et cetera, they have the ability to connect to the global market. So even if the purchasing power or inflation goes up in Lebanon, people in the U.S., the diaspora communities in the U.S., in Michigan, in New York, et cetera, can purchase, and that's what they needed the grant for to some extent.
So what, you know, one of the knocks on the Middle East is that it is, you know,
just one or
yeah, well, one of the knocks
I'm
is,
the second one.
Is that, you know, I mean, there are oil rich countries. And then, you know, when you have an economy that's completely built around one commodity, that almost always leads to, you know, a terrible government and, you know, people not really developing a multifaceted economy. But in the Middle East, a lot of people say there isn't an entrepreneurial spirit. Is part of what you're showing in Untold Stories of the Middle East, is that's wrong? Or is it hard to start businesses there because of the way the government functions?
The good thing about, so I've always looked at oil as a curse. I call it oil as that, in a way, is that it shifted more countries towards dependency on the government being the supplier of everything. However, some governments, like, for example, the government of the United Arab Emirates and the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, to some extent, they've all had built up visions called Vision 2030 or Vision 2040 in some places. And the whole idea is to diversify away from oil. So moving the country more towards privatization and also kind of spreading your portfolio across different businesses. So the oil situation is actually changing because of the fact that dependency on oil has decreased. The U.S. is now the largest producer of oil, so there is less dependency on the Gulf oil from the U.S., but also from China, there's still dependency. So some of these stuff are actually changing for the better, in my opinion. And some countries are moving in the right direction. For you to start a business, you actually need an ecosystem, and that ecosystem includes regulations and the Middle East, because of the fact of the massive wave of nationalist socialism, which is a combination of worst ideologies probably in the world, has been dominated a lot in many countries in the region, including where I come from in Iraq. So they have pushed that, made it a lot of anti-business policies. And even in Kurdistan, where we operate, and that's what we work with Atlas Network about, we actually have been looking at a lot of laws from the 60s and the 70s of the fact that you have to get signatures in every other department for you to do that. And our goal is to move the registration from 3 months to 3 days. And that's now, so in a way, we actually have to do a lot of work in really making the regulations. But the third option, which is, I think, the most obvious one, is security. Is that in order for you to have prosperous businesses and investment ecosystems and stock markets, et cetera, you need to have security apparatus. And that's why when you look at kind of Middle East at large, you see the countries that are more secure, like the Gulf states, which has U.S. military bases, and they have kind of security contracts with the West. They have been able to have the investment ecosystem, and that's why you can see people from around the world investing in Dubai, investing in Saudi Arabia, because they can guarantee that the building is not going to be blown up in the next 10 minutes, as in the case in some places. And that's why many people are worried to invest in Kurdistan, except the oil industry and the security industry complex. So there needs to be more diversification as more security comes in.
Let's talk a little bit about the origin story of Ideas Beyond Borders. You mentioned before, it's a 501c3 nonprofit. It was founded in 2017. one of the main things that you do, or what you started out doing, was taking texts written by people like Sam Harris and Steve Pinker, translating them into Arabic, and then distributing them for free as ebooks. What was the thinking behind that?
So the thinking behind it is that growing up in the Arabic internet and the Arabic ecosystem on the information ecosystem, if you go to a bookstore in Jordan right now, when you see some of the featured bookstores are Mein Kampf, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and the Communist Book, the Communist Manifesto, which are great books. So if you look at the information ecosystem, and that's actually in a way tells you the history of waves in the Middle East. I mean, mm-hmm. Nazism and fascism and communism being in the center of the world has made it a place that many of these ideologies spread. And what is unavailable was the values of freedom, which is the values of classical liberalism, of critical thinking, of science. So when we looked at this, like, it was a very big challenge. I think the Google research was like only 0.5% of content is available in Arabic. One of the biggest challenges we actually faced at the beginning, and we're still facing in some languages other than Arabic, is that there is actually no vocabulary for freedom. So the economic terminologies that exist in Hayek or exist in Adam Smith and exist in most of the works are actually not available in the language because there has not been a lot of literature. So one of the things we actually had to create, and now we institutionalize it, we actually just hired an economist studying economy in Germany, but he's from Syria, is actually inventing some of the words that need to exist for spreading the so there is the element of actually making the glossary and the knowledge of like the words available, and the other thing is actually making them accessible, and that's where the ebooks come in. In fact, I would say our most successful enterprise, which I think now is the larger program, as because we started with the books, and then in order for us to go through, like we build the programs, we always think about it, how can we have enough that we don't need to do any the work anymore? It's like, what is the tipping point? And we started with Wikipedia as well. So we translated about 40,000 articles. And now if you go to artificial intelligence, you will see that many of the terminologies that we actually helped translate in the open source are now available on the artificial intelligence because we actually fed that.
Can you talk about in Wikipedia, you've translated about 40,000 articles.
Maybe more by now. Yeah.
And, you know, in Arabic, so before that, Arabic Wikipedia just didn't have that much content or that much content about kind of liberal economic and political ideas.
Yes. And most of what was available actually was kind of a biased history, Islamic history and things of that sort, a very specific version. Some of it was actually funded by states, and there was an article on that they discovered that some of the Wikipedia articles were actually state-funded of people who wanted to push a certain narrative. So then we actually had to really kind of start from scratch in most cases of really looking at, oh, the Wealth of Nations, there's nothing. And then you have to create it all from scratch, creating the right glossary and indexing it correctly. And the idea is that is a place where, I mean, Wikipedia, if you search on Google, it's going to be the first thing that appears. So now finally, the Arabic internet actually looks normal. When you search for something, you can actually find the thing you're looking for on the first thing, not like an article from Al Jazeera saying Adam Smith was like a Zionist agent or something like that. Mm. And then it's like, this is the first. So now it was like, we're actually making the Arabic internet look normal like any other country in the world.
Is it hard to access the internet depending on the country?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the most extreme is Yemen. And that is because there is very little infrastructure of internet and also the fact like content wars. So that's the most difficult. Iran has one of the highest censorship regimes with still like terms and conditions. I think what's the rest of the region is like, it depends. Syria, I think, is also on the list of kind of the worst. We get one of the things when we designed our organization with the help of Google, actually Jigsaw, they have a way in which you can mirror the websites like 20 different servers. Mm-hmm. And if it's got banned in a certain country, they switch in a different IP address so it can still be accessed in that banned country. So in that way, we are able to like be available even when we are censored. So we're actually kind of bypassed some of that. That being said, there is the digital element, but there's also the physical elements. And I think that's where like places like Iran is like, even if sometimes you read a Steven Pinker book or you're viewed by the government, as you can actually obviously read the Steven Pinker book in your bedroom, but if you are somebody watches you from the besieged or from the IRGC, then when you get into trouble. And that's where like there's an element of physical security when you actually download some of that content or print it. So that's where things get a bit messy.
And you use is it dozens or hundreds of translators or people who are in the countries that we're talking about actually translating and doing this work?
Yes. So and that's really our model. I always say is like, if it costs $500 to be a member of Al-Qaeda, it should be $500 to translate liberalism. Mm. So we actually want to create a business model for, like, if extremists have the business and the funding, for those of us who actually believe in peace and liberalism should actually also make it, like, create a business model for us to survive. And so in ways, like, our reason why we support there in the Middle East is not only because it's cheaper, obviously it is cheaper, but also to actually support the region there for them to have agency to fight for these values and really support them in doing so.
Who are the people who work for you? Obviously not, you know, with any identifying details, but what draws somebody to want to be part of this project if they're living in Syria or Lebanon or Iraq?
So the great thing of what happened, like, especially I think in 2017 in particular, is that, I mean, our policy is that we don't reinvent the wheel. So we're always, think of us as also a talent organization, not just, and we try, so my first course of action is actually identify other groups that are doing this. And I found that there were actually massive efforts already existing of doing translation. One of them is called I Believe in Science, like kind of the National Geographic of the Arab World, has 4.5 million followers. We acquired them with one of the first things. So, like, one of the deals I made, sounds like a mafia deal to some extent, is that I brought many of the leaders of this kind of initiatives, underground or overground. I was like, listen, there's been all these efforts that has never been institutionalized. And I think what we can do together is, like, IBB can be the institution for these values. So many of these people have already launched these efforts. So what we did is that, so when we went from like zero to where we are right now with 8.5, is actually a lot of it is acquisition and growth with these people. So many of these people, I mean, I can talk more about the context of how all that happened, but we are, I would say, part of the third wave. So, like, people have tried communism, they have tried theocracy, and they've tried socialism, and they're looking for an alternative. And we are that alternative. I wouldn't want to exaggerate in saying, like, oh, we are the number one. There is a lot of work to be done, but I think I'm willing to fight it.
Talk a little bit about those successive waves of, you know, the Middle East was carved up by colonial powers, by European powers, as well as the Turks and whatnot. And then in the 20th century, I mean, everywhere there came a wave of kind of nationalist fervor, and that often took either a fascistic or a communist flavoring. What were the motive forces in the Middle East that kind of turned it one way or the other?
So I'm gonna give like the 30 seconds version. But speaking of the Turks, I was actually in a debate or like discussion at NYU, and they said that Turks were not colonial because they were not white. So I guess we should not include the Turks in the list of colonial forces. Just joking.
I'm not sure that the Belgians are white either.
That's true. Maybe their beer is white, but not them personally. So I actually obviously add the Turks to the list of colonial forces. So. I would say after not to go back too much in history, but after Turkey or Ottoman Empire lost World War I, there were two, the main question was for the Arab world, there's a book called The Arabs that explained that in detail, but the question is like, why did we fail? What actually happened that explains that failure in which us going back in history, in which used to occupy literally half of the planet, all the way to southern Spain, to Central Asia, in which the Arabic and the Islamic world used to be a world of conquest. It used to be taken over the planet. And suddenly now we are colonized by the British and the French and others, and our borders are being divided by these colonial forces. So this is, I would say, the mentality of the Arabs. I studied under Saddam Hussein. That's how we were brainwashed this from the beginning, is that we were great and we got screwed over. And the answer to these questions, the most two important waves, are the nationalists. And the nationalists, which is actually a combination of multiple thinkers and intellectuals, some of them are Christians from Lebanon, who are like, we failed because we were not united enough on race. So the reason why Arabs did not stand up for each other, And we got screwed over by the outsiders.
And this means Arabs, you know, from Morocco all the way through Iraq.
To Iraq. So it's like we got screwed over. So we were united because Arabs did not stand up for each other and we allowed each other to lose. And that's where like people like Michel Aflaq and eventually that got into the Ba'ath Party and the Nasserist movement. And this is like all the pan-Arab nationalists, which is a combination of really nationalism with a Soviet dose of socialism and national socialism. That's one thing. The other movement was we failed because we were not religious enough. And that's where came in the Muslim Brotherhood and all of the, what's sometimes called the Islamist movement or the political Islamic movement, is that we failed because we were not religious enough. And the best way for us is to be united under the one religion and create a theocracy and build on Islamic law. That obviously has not happened and eventually created the variations we saw today of ISIS and other and Hamas and other of these kind of more violent political forces.
And that is, I mean, if the pan-Arab movement just based on, you know, the idea that Moroccans and Iraqis have a lot in common, right?
And they should share the same vision and the same
leaders. But then with the religious aspect you're talking, I mean, there are major divisions within Sunni Islam, much less Shia and Sunni Islam.
And you just explained why these ideas is felt. is that when you go to the details, yes, there is like very like the Moroccans, in fact, even the dialect of Morocco is actually very different than the dialect of Iraq. So it's very hard for us to understand each other, leave aside. Right. But obviously there is a common culture and a common kind of theme. And many of these, something to be actually interesting about these movements, they're also kind of hybrid. So you can also have, like when I grew up, Saddam Hussein, he started as a secular leader, Arab national secularist leader, but he actually switched to being a theocrat after he lost to America in 1991. He's like, oh, Arab nationalism did not work because the Arabs have screwed me over, and now Kuwait screwed me over, Saudi. So now he moved into religion, and then he built like wrote the Quran with his own blood, and then he became the descendant of Prophet Muhammad, and then the rest is history. So some of these forces are actually
work out so well. I haven't heard from Saddam lately.
No, I mean, some people still believe he's alive. So maybe I'm the representation of Saddam.
When it came out that he had written the Quran in his own blood or had added his blood to the vat, I was talking about this earlier with some people. Kiss, the rock band Kiss, did that with Marvel Comics in the 1970s. So it was like he was a little bit late to that game.
Yeah.
Because they printed a comic book.
He censored the internet and radio, so maybe he was not hearing it.
Yeah. So nationalism fell. I mean, it was a kind of it helped create the post-colonial period because the Arab countries did get independence, but then the pan-Arab movement under Nasser in particular did not work. How is the theocratic project going? Because it obviously, parts of the Middle East are still, you know, very, very hyper-religious, not all of them, but I don't want to say is that failing. It seems kind of self-evident that it's not creating a unified Arab world or a unified Islamic world. But, what do you think is going to happen next in terms of, you know, the theocracies in the Middle East?
In the most important year, I think, in the modern Middle East is 1979. And that's when the Ayatollah Khamenei took over the an overthrow of the Shah. And that was, in a way, a very success moment for the Islamic movements.
There was also a siege of Mecca.
Exactly. Right? On the Shia side of things, it was the overthrow of the Shah. On the Sunni side of things was the siege of Mecca by the Wahhabi elements. So that's what I would say they had kind of the peak where, and the Ayatollah Khomeini at the time was an inspiration for a lot of other voices in which, okay, if Iran can do it, we can do it as well. Mm-hmm. And then slowly some of that took kind of a more microcosm, like in the case of Lebanon, in which Hezbollah and Harakat Amal, which is the kind of the nonviolent element of that ideology, rose up. So that's on the Lebanon context. And then in Gaza or Palestine, there was the Hamas movement. So I would say it's like the biggest start was the Iranian Revolution, because, and also the Iranian Revolution created a reaction from the Sunni side. So because the Iran built up this the kind of successful example of Shia theocracy, the Sunnis were like, number one, feeling afraid because Iran is an expansionist country. So then the Sunni states, including Saudi Arabia, were funding all of these extremist movements as a way to counter Shia expansionism, in addition to the Cold War politics of funding anti-Soviets in Afghanistan and things of that sort. So in a way, it's like the Iranian revolution stood up, then all of these extremist Sunnis came in as a way to react to that, and then it created most of the challenges we actually face today. And obviously, I'm one of the schools who's fighting to make sure this groups fail. So that's I would say is a life mission. And my goal is like to make sure that this is the last war Lebanon has, because it's a country that needs that. This actually these forces, like the forces of theocracy that came from Iran, do not represent the majority of the Lebanese will and the Lebanese people. So I think that we actually can defeat these voices if we have enough will and we have enough support.
But you have talked in various places about kind of the liberal minority in places like Lebanon and whatnot. Who are they, and you know, how many troops do they have, and you know, how do they? I mean, how does that build out a world? Because some of the first books that you translated into Arabic were about secular governance and things, and things like science, which has to be free of kind of religious dictates. This is something that Europe went through, you know, hundreds of years ago. But who are the liberals in Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East, and how do you grow their numbers?
So the good thing about Lebanon is that they've had for a long time a culture that allowed a sense of freedom of expression and creativity. So they're not the easiest place to work in, but also not the hardest. There are some places in the region where we also work where it's actually much harder. The problem that liberals have to some extent is that we don't have a militia. So when all of the other groups like Hezbollah and others, And that's actually what makes it really difficult to be outspoken in some of these places, is that many of these militias, at the beginning, they send you a letter, which is a death threat, and then they try to kill you. So the thing is, like, that created a weakness that I think a lot of the liberal voices have, is that they don't actually have a backing. And there is actually a very famous Lebanese comedian who said, well, the Sunnis have Saudi Arabia and the Shias have Iran, but the liberals have nobody but God. And the joke is like there's nobody supporting the liberals. Yeah. Because if you are a Sunni militia, if I was from a Sunni extremist faction or Shia extremist faction, I can go in a meeting in Tehran and raise $10 million and get AK-47s and build up what Hezbollah did, an entire infrastructure, entire. But if I was a liberal, and now they actually have nobody else to support them. And that's, I think, what makes them weak. However, now with the fall, or now called the fall, I don't want to be too optimistic on that note, but with the weakening of Hezbollah, to be clear, now with the killing of the leader of the charismatic leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, who was a very, like, he had a talk every Friday, and most people in the region watched that talk. Now that he's gone, now there's actually a lot of momentum as Hezbollah is busy restructuring, that many of these liberal voices are actually coming out. Which were not the case before when the Hezbollah was more powerful. And in Iraq, we actually had our biggest wave in 2019 called the Tishrin movements, where finally that liberal voices got institutionalized. It was a bunch of voices, bloggers and people spoken on Facebook. But then after the Tishrin movement, we figured out that it's actually not enough just to talk on Facebook or to talk at magazines. It actually is time for us to institutionalized and built political coalition. And I think as of now, the liberal coalition has roughly about 20 to 24 members of the Iraqi parliament that support to some extent free enterprise. Of course, we're going against a massive wave of pro-Iranian parties and things like that. But slowly but surely, the institutionalization of liberal ideas is finally coming, which was not the case for the past 40 years.
Does it help or hurt that the United States is not in the region like it used to be?
Well, that's a big question. Does it hurt if the U.S. withdraws? The answer is yes, because of the fact if the U.S. does not exist, somebody else is going to fill that vacuum, and it's going to, when you're dealing with kind of 3-4 major powers, if we include Iran being one. Then if the U.S. withdraws, somebody else is doing that. That being said, there is, and back to kind of the Kurdistan example, is that there is a good intervention and a bad intervention. So when the thing with the Kurdistan situation is that there was even the first Gulf War itself, it had a very specific mission, which is removing Saddam from Kuwait and then creating a no-fly zone for the Kurds for them to flourish. The problem with the Iraq War was it started with weapons of mass destruction, changed into nation building, then it became war on terrorism, then I don't know what the fuck happened, and then they withdrawn. So that is really the story of the Iraq War as I lived it. It was mm-hmm. like the combination of really changing missions as we go, which created a very bad intervention. And then in the case of Afghanistan, the U.S. has spent $3 trillion in Afghanistan to replace the Taliban with the Taliban.
Right.
So this is another failed intervention it might mean the case actually if the U.S. would have stayed in Afghanistan, we would have less likely to prevent it. And I think, however, there is definitely a conversation to be had between a good intervention and a bad intervention. I think the war in Iraq in particular has backfired because now there's very little trust in the U.S. as an institution. In fact, if the U.S. did the Iraq war better, now the case against supporting dissident voices against Bashar al-Assad or dissident voices against the Ayatollah. I mean, when I go to Washington, D.C. and I talk to State Department and others, they have what I call the Iraq syndrome. It's like, we interfered there, it failed. We're not going to support anybody else in the Middle East. It's over. It's a lost subject. And the thing is like, but that's what I say, like the Middle East is always like a series of missed opportunities. Because now we're seeing a lot of people are fighting for freedom. And now we're saying, no, we're not doing anything because we failed in one place.
And I guess it's more complicated than that too, right? Because when you mention Iran, the United States and certainly Britain were implicated in the coup in 1953 that brought the Shah into power and whatnot. So it kind of depends on when you say, okay, this is when history begins.
And also
whether or not you have a good or bad reputation.
So one thing to add is like most of the U.S. intervention, if you want to call it U.S. intervention, is actually protecting trade routes. So most of like, I mean, there's the U.S. intervention, we see it through wars and things like that. But if you look at most of the trade that actually goes through the Gulf and we call it the Arab Sea, but they call it the Persian Sea. Some people, that's a conflict that's always going to exist. But a lot of U.S. presence, which is U.S. military bases in the Gulf, they don't necessarily engage in warfare. They're actually there to protect some of these places, but also in agreement with the regions there, but also to protect trade routes. So not all intervention is actually, unfortunately, the one that gets the most media and sometimes the one that the U.S. spends the most on is actually the wars that eventually backfires. And case of Iran is also a bit more complicated because that was during the Cold War and Mossadegh was also pro-Soviet. So he was a victim of the kind of the Cold War mentality of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Well, and I mean, not to stay on this too long, but I mean, the U.S. supports Israel, it supports Egypt, it supports Jordan, UAE, Saudi Arabia. Like, so have we really left the region?
No, which is, I think it's, I always like, to, I mean, if we're going to engage in this theoretical conversation, it's always good to imagine the world without the U.S. intervention. And I think it's going to be most likely, especially, like, I mean, Israel's conversation is obviously complicated, but if you look at like kind of the Gulf states like the UAE and Saudi, etc., if there is no one, if Iran would actually try to attack Aramco right now, which is one of the largest oil companies, then you're actually going to make the whole Saudi economy dysfunctional. It can destroy not the entire energy routes, but a significant amount. So in a way, it's like we also have to look at the cost of non-intervening. And I think I see that the cost-benefit analysis is that good interventions, which I think could be an entire 7-book series written on what they mm-hmm. sound like, could actually be much more better than non-interventions because somebody else is gonna. That being said, actually, I do, because I know we're in a liberal or classical liberal crowd. I would argue that part of the reason why the Abrahamic Accords happened is the U.S. withdrawal from the region. So in a mm-hmm. way, is that part of the reason why the Abrahamic Accords actually in the UAE and UAE and right. Israel signed the deal was kind of the realization under the Obama administration and to a large extent under the Trump administration, because Aramco was attacked during the Trump administration and Trump's response was, this is not an American military base, we're not here to protect you. So it's your, mm-hmm. you're under this. So the Saudis get the hint, okay, the U.S. is withdrawing. They saw that Russia is intervening in Syria and successfully protected Assad. Then they're like, okay, so now we're already living in a post-U.S. world. And they were like, okay, so we have Israel. We might not like them that much, but they hate the Iranians. And we have a much more better deals for us as a region to build regional integration with Israel as part of it than for us to be eventually be attacked by Iran and have nobody else to defend us. So in a way, it's like somebody can argue it both ways, is that to some extent, when the U.S. withdraws, people in the region take more agency and some good things happen, in my opinion, like the Abrahamic Accords that enhances economic integration, economic collaboration, and is good for everybody. But at the same time, we don't know yet if the U.S. fully withdraws, which is not the case anymore, what will happen.
Do you think the Hamas attacks from a year ago on Israel, obviously, an attempt to disrupt any kind of growing accords between Israel and other countries in the region, has that derailed things completely, or does it just change the timetable of new regional, kind of agreements between Israel and Saudi Arabia, UAE, et cetera, coming into being?
Well, what day is it? Let me see if I'm optimistic. So the answer is yes, it has derailed. I mean, I think a significant reason why the October 7th attack happened was to derail the Saudi-Israel normalization. And even the New York Times actually revealed some of the Sinwar's documents of why he did October 7th that they recently found out. And they found that this is one of the reasons, of course, not the main reason, but was a veto power that Hamas had, which is like, this is our chance. And there was an interview that actually Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, did on Fox 2 weeks before October 7th, what he was saying about, oh, we're getting closer, normalization is going closer. And there were some kind of conditions that Saudi has put for the normalization to happen, which was, number one, and it's very similar to actually other Abrahamic Accords when you look at the details. So with Morocco, Morocco wanted the United States to recognize the Great Sahara as part of Morocco, and Trump actually recognized the Great Sahara as part of Morocco, and then there was the deal. In the case of Saudi, there were a couple of conditions. One is that they wanted more F-16s. The other one, they wanted the nuclear powers to replace the reliance on coal and oil. And the third one was the creation of a Palestinian state, because they were afraid that if the status quo is there and they normalize or make a deals with Israel, they're going to be an internal revolution against them or from the other parts of the region. It's like, okay, you gave up too easily. Mm-hmm. You let the Israelis do it without Palestinian existence. And then they were afraid of and now it's like recently that I think MBS sent a letter to the Congress saying he's afraid of assassination, because even the media right now, even the Saudi media, and I actually did, I'm going to publish an article doing a review of the Arab media 1 year after October 7th. And actually, a significant amount of the media by the UAE and Saudi Arabia and the other Arab states are actually mostly critical of October 7th. They think it was an absolute failure, it accomplished nothing. And really, I mean, look at Gaza before. Now it's like we're discussing with Israel a return to day before October 7th. Forget about the borders of 1967 or 1948 or all the UN resolutions. We're actually discussing, can we go back to October 6th? So that's like the most actually common theme if you watch Al Arabiya and Mashhad and many of the channels in the Arab world. So there's a great disappointment. I think hopefully that disappointment can turn to something positive and the integration can happen. But I definitely, without quoting, I say is that at least the Abrahamic Accords are delayed between 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And for anything to actually go back to October 6th, for us to go back to, I remember I was in the United Arab Emirates a year before October 7th. I was there in 2022, and it was an event about October 7th about Abrahamic Accords. And there was the ministers from the UAE and even Israel and tech companies from Israel and AI and BI technology and all of that. And they were all celebrating the fact that, oh, we're going to have UAE investors coming to Tel Aviv and Tel Aviv people partying in Dubai and all of that stuff. And now, there was actually, I think, a report from the Abrahamic Accords Institute, which I think based in London. Most of these people who actually joined these meetings refused to be invited to any meeting about Abrahamic Accords. So actually, they have 0% retention rate, which tells you that the mood is actually very low. So I would say it's like, even with if there's a magic wand, I will make it 5 years. But if there is, things go the way they are, it's probably going to take 5, 10, and who knows? The Middle East is an ongoing living organism.
Yeah. You mentioned the Taliban a little while ago. One of the other things that IBB does is fund schools for girls. Yep. Now, can you talk a little bit about that, and how do they operate in a new, you know, in a new Taliban Afghanistan?
So that's, I would say, like one of innovative but really interesting and sometimes sad story is that after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban came back, as you know, and one of the things they instituted was that women cannot continue higher education. So as a result, some of the professors and teachers who for the first time went to class during the U.S. intervention because their parents were never been to college, were like, okay, we don't want to the girls today to face what our parents have faced. So they started kind of like an underground movement of people donating their houses and the teachers going to these houses, continuing the education for these girls. And I got to actually know the story from the Deutsche Welle, which is the German channel, and the journalist was like, I don't want to give you all the details, but I actually just discovered this, which is like I'm meeting with a group of teachers who are doing this underground work, which I think could be very aligned with your organization and education and things like that. So like, okay, like this sounds too good to be true. And I was like, I don't want to end up on the US government watch list for supporting the wrong people. And then we actually had multiple vetting conversation to make sure they're real, and we contact a lot of people. And yes, they are real. And we built up this special program for them that it's a combination of continuing education but also vocational and digital training. So for them, they can like have skill sets like graphic design and things like that in which they can still function and work and get paid online. So in a way, there's some element of functional economy within that community. So it's a combination of multiple things. It is on our website. You see IBB and then Underground Schools of Afghanistan for more details.
Is there any sense of, I guess the revolutions that actually change countries really come from within, including, and that's true of the Iranian Revolution, that brought the Islamic Republic into being, as well as eventually the revolution that topples it. But in Afghanistan, is there an internal movement to replace the Taliban, or is that just not even, you know, worth thinking about right now?
So when I first read about Afghanistan, I'm obviously one of the most famous statements is called the graveyard of empires. Hmm. And I was like, oh, this is not true. Then I read it and I was like, oh, maybe. So the issue, I mean, which brings us back to World War One and kind of the complex history of these nations, is that I'm a believer that sometimes when it's too difficult to hold a nation together, maybe this nation should not exist as it is right now. And I would definitely say that in the case of Afghanistan. I mean, that might be a controversial opinion for some, but the thing is that the Taliban is, yes, as a religious movement and they're theocrats, etc., but they're also, so there's an ethnic element to the Taliban. They're Pashtuns, majority Pashtuns, and they feel that they are being discriminated against by the Tajiks, etc. So the thing is, like, with the Tajik part of Afghanistan, there is a very famous leader which was actually killed 2 days before 9/11. His name is Ahmad Shah Massoud. And actually, Al-Qaeda killed him in Afghanistan. And now his son took some leadership to actually fight the Taliban right now. So there's actually a movement inside Afghanistan that is militarily fighting the Taliban in some areas in Panjshir and some parts of the northern parts. The issue, so that's the good part is that this thing is happening. So there is obviously a movement of fighting. The good part is that, the bad part is that it's so difficult to create an inclusive government when you have traumas and things are building up over time. Okay, you killed my cousin, I killed your cousin. This idea of like going back together and singing Kumbaya is not going to happen. I mean, you would expect it in a lot of other places. So I think Afghanistan is part of that story, is that there is a lot of work needs to be done of like really trying to figure out, can actually this country exist as it is right now? And I would say the same case, I mean Joe Biden's famous argument about Iraq was that Iraq needed to be divided to three countries of Kurdistan and kind of Shiastan and Sunnistan. However, in Iraq is very complicated because Baghdad is actually a very inclusive multicultural city. So where would that go? So there are some parts that are more difficult, and there's already a shared history and tradition. But there are some parts where there's more segregation. And so I think it's like the shortly answer to your question is that yes, forces fighting the Taliban right now, I'm semi-optimistic about them, but not fully optimistic. And I think there's more conversation to be done about can the country of Afghanistan exist as it is right now, because it's unsustainable, and there might be a way to kind of divide the country in which one part of it will be more liberal, kind of South Korea, North Korea situation. You have the North Korea being communist and South Korea being prosperous, free society, and this situation and model could actually work in many of these areas.
I think I speak for everyone when I say nobody wants to be in North Korea.
I'm sure yeah, there's... Yeah. What was the basketball player who went there?
Yeah, Dennis Rodman. Even he didn't stay. You grew up in Baghdad. What year were you born?
1991.
So, I mean, you brought an American invasion and
COVID.
Talk about what was it like growing up in Baghdad after Saddam was kicked out of Kuwait.
So, I mean, in Iraqi terminology, I'm called a sanctions boy. So I was born during the sanctions, the U.S. sanctions on Iraq from 1991 until the war. So, I mean, I remember vividly, actually, the day of the fall of Saddam Hussein, which my older brother was upstairs. And then he is like, oh, there's a tank in front of our house. And then at the same time, downstairs, we're watching news saying that Americans are being defeated in Nasiriyah, which is in the south, and they're getting their ass kicked. And you look at these photos of the U.S. soldiers being killed and kidnapped and all that stuff, which most of them end up being fake footage. It's actually not real. But then it's like my brother is like, there's literally like U.S. military in front of our house. And then within a couple of hours, my elementary school was a military base of the Iraqi army, and the U.S. bombed the elementary school. And then we're like, oh, so the U.S. is actually in Iraq right now, in Baghdad. Wow. I remember that night very well because it was like endless war between the two sides, the Iraqi army. And then I remember the next day, one of my brother friends came in like pretty much naked with like white. And he's like, I'm in the Iraqi army and all of us are resigning right now. And the war is done. Saddam is gone. And I still remember like, what? What are you talking about? Like Saddam? I remember like my mom and my dad who grew up their entire lives, almost their entire lives in Saddam Hussein, they had like a major shock factor. Like, are you like, really? Saddam Hussein, the guy that we always thought the most powerful, and he's like kicked out in like 2 weeks and after. So that's my first memory of the war, which ended in April 2003. And then within kind of 7 months, so my neighborhood, my dad's profession is he's an orthopedic surgeon. So during Saddam time and during socialist countries, for those of you who grew up in there, they actually, the government sometimes decides where the doctor should live and where. So I was like, oh, Baghdad needs 10 months of orthopedics and 10 months of that. So my dad actually relocated to Baghdad, and my neighborhood was a neighborhood where many of Saddam Hussein generals used to live in. So our neighborhood within time switched from residential neighborhood into al-Mujahideen, which is actually eventually called al-Qaeda. So we moved, our neighborhood moved from like a peaceful, to some extent, peaceful family-oriented neighborhood to literally people who used to be pro-Saddam left the country to Jordan and to Qatar and all of the neighboring countries. And then most of the houses became empty. And then there were all these people coming in from like Chechnya and like all countries like Uzbekistan, and I was even hearing Russian speaking in our neighborhood, and I was like, what the hell? So our neighborhood like moved from that to like Times Square of terrorism within like months, really. So with that happening, I mean, how does that look like in practice? Was a lot of checkpoints that stop in the middle of the streets, they're like kind of covered up, and then they ask people whether they're Sunni and Shia. And my case, I'm what considered the tradition of sushis. I'm a sushi. So actually, I grew up under the Sunni tradition of Saddam Hussein, actually, because I studied under, and my name is traditionally Sunni name, but my mom is from Najaf, which is the holiest site of Shia Islam. So in a way, it's like identity crisis in building. Yeah. So my brother at the time had to create two other fake IDs because our last name is actually not good enough for people to know whether you're Sunni or Shia. So we actually had to create two fake IDs and all these checkpoints based on their flag and their, and you have to, they ask you, are you Sunni or Shia? Then you have to give them the right ID. And sometimes if they're skeptical, they ask you to pray in front of, and then to check your, to take your religion. And then that's where was the start of the civil war. So, and then the Sunnis and the Shias were killing each other. Fast forward, and you can see actually my talk on also Freedom Forum, where I talk about that in detail. But fast forward, like in 2007, back to the U.S. intervention, the U.S. launched something called the Surge. And my neighborhood was one of the areas that were affected by the surge. So I grew up about 1 hour away from Fallujah, which is where the area where the most U.S. military were killed. So they were looking for, that was actually my first interaction with the war, where there was the surge and then the group called the Sons of Iraq. And then there was the Iraqi government working this coalition. And I was this young boy translating between these three people. And then, like, within a couple of years, I ended up on a death list. And here I am in Jonathan's apartment with the Reason magazine. So thank you.
With what your parents were not believers in Saddam Hussein, and they were not particularly religious, right? So what was it like to grow up in an authoritarian state where you had a supreme leader, but you kind of also knew that it was bullshit?
Well, I would say it's like with my parents in particular, the biggest feeling was disappointment. So my parents lived in Iraq, where it was far more prosperous than under Saddam Hussein. And they both, my dad in particular, studied in the United Kingdom. So my dad actually went on a scholarship to Edinburgh University, and that's where he got his certificate of orthopedic surgery. And then when in the 80s, he decided, now I'm educated, I want to go back, fix my country. Now I have this great education, and my mother is a lawyer. So I think she's a constitutional lawyer and then civil law. And they were both like, let's go back to Iraq. Seems like there is a great opportunity. And then within like 2 years, Saddam invades Kuwait. And then they had sex and I was born. So that's my life. That's the first chapter of my biography.
Yeah. Wow.
So
shock and awe. Right?
Shock and awe, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. My first two experiences with authoritarianism was, so I grew up under the sanctions post-First mm-hmm. Gulf War. The United States and France had radio stations that they used to broadcast into Iraq during that period of time. And my dad, who obviously was not a fan of Saddam Hussein and saw all of the bad economic policies and everything, me and him used to actually wake up and listen to a channel called Monte Carlo, which is the French channel broadcasting into Iraq of like, oh, hey, we are former Ba'ath Party people and we think Saddam is evil and we ask people to rise up and all that sometimes. And then there is a U.S. channel called Radio Sawa, which is part of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which was like combination of like Western music into like some anything that's like Western, and they used to broadcast it. And then for Baghdad is a bit further from the borders. So we actually have to, it's later at night where you can actually get good signal versus like places like Basra and Kurdistan, where they had better. So that was my first experience with authoritarianism, was actually my dad saying that like, we actually had to be in hiding, listening to radio, and if everybody else watching us, that would be the end. And the other thing we noticed, which actually shows the corruption of authoritarianism, was that those of his friends who were Ba'athist and close to the regime had satellite television, they had BMWs and Mercedes. So like, there were actually two realities of Iraq during Saddam Hussein, which is like, there were those who were close to the regime who had really luxurious, to some extent, a free life. I mean, even when the internet was accessible, those people if were on the top were able to have internet and all of that. Well, those of us who did not have allegiance to the regime were screwed up. And so that's the other thing. The other kind of experience, which is, I would say, was more daily, was like my parents, kind of like the kind of educational talk, which is like everything we say in the house, especially if it was critical of Saddam Hussein, you should not say it outside the house, because I was a kid and they're like, nothing said here should be repeated. And the theory was, one out of four adults is at the intelligence services. So you actually never know who, like you could be talking to a friend or a cousin or a relative and you don't know if they're actually gonna report you. So that's, I would say, like the two experiences that really like shaped for me what live under authoritarianism. And then we hear like within a week after the war or 2 weeks, this guy fell. I was like, what? Like this whole apparatus, this whole like demigod that he used to have is like now gone. And obviously it was not fully gone because all the militias start coming out after when the Civil War happened.
I guess we're going to do a few questions in a minute, but just to kind of wrap up, could you talk a little bit about, are you optimistic about the regions of the world that IBB operates in? You know, the Middle East, Central Asia, increasingly places like Iran. You know, are you optimistic that, you know, does freedom win, you know, inevitably, or is it, you know, a lot of luck and a lot of work? How do you feel about the next 5 years and the next 15 years?
I mean, my dad always says, we don't have the privilege to be depressed. So I actually don't have a choice but to be optimistic. I would say, I mean, I do have the bias that because of IDSBM Motors and the work we do, I am connected to really people who are on the front lines who are fighting for freedom. So by default of really being always connected to people fighting for these values gives me a lot of optimism. And then, however, there is always externalities. I mean, I wrote an article on my Substack is that we as Arab liberals did not decide October 7th. We did not have any play in all of what's happening. And now, you know, like, in a way, we got screwed up in all of these external factors of Hezbollah firing rockets and then the liberal Lebanese having to be stuck in that situation within the war. So I think is that I'm very optimistic about some places in the Middle East. I would say Lebanon, there is a great opportunity right now of people really after removing of the head of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, there's a lot of people fighting and we're actually working a lot on that. Iran, I had optimism during the revolution. I'm less optimistic right now. I think there is some agreement even within the Biden administration that we have to contain Iran. And one of my, I guess, contradictions about Iraq is that I don't think Saddam could have been removed without military force. And I think the same about Iran. So I think the likelihood that the U.S. would do anything with the current Biden administration is very unlikely. So I think Iran is going to stay as it is. Jordan and other, I'm optimistic about Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of movement towards economic liberalism and others. So yeah, some regions are more optimistic than others. But I think regardless of what we do, I mean, in America, it was not built in a day and there was a lot of work. Now all of these freedoms we take for granted as a result of a lot of people fighting for it. So I think I want to support those who want to build the freedom for their countries.
A final word. One of the things that it's been interesting to see as IBB grows over time, the emphasis on economic self-determination and economic freedom. And you talk about how running a business or having economic freedom really changes the mindset in terms of politics and culture. Can you just discuss that a little bit?
And I love discussing that, is that when I was discussing all of these wars and conflicts and all of that stuff, one of the things that they rob away from you is agency. What dictatorships do and what these conflicts do is that they take agency away from you. And while starting a business and going into innovating stuff that actually change people's lives and they're profitable and can grow is actually giving back the agency to these people. So one of the things that I do love about the whole free market, free enterprise model is that it gives people a lot of agency. And most importantly with innovation is that, I mean, there's a great concept called the brain drain, is that because of these, if the economic situation is not there, many of these talented people end up immigrating. So if they have agency and the situation is decent or relatively peaceful in their countries, they were more likely to stay than they're going to be in a refugee camp in Sweden. So we actually have to invest in these people because the future of these countries and the development of these countries is going to come from mostly from these innovators and the people who have took agency over themselves.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Faisal Said.
Thank you so much.
Of IDSBM Borders.